Hello, welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Coramdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we get to sit down and talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about Mark Sayer's new book, Reappearing Church.
A couple introductory things. First, we're down a man again, Dusty White, out sick today. And that's going to be a bummer for him.
Yeah.
Because we're enjoying something delicious provided by a Wednesday Conversation listener.
Yep.
We want to encourage all of our listeners to feel free to bring us food and drink at any time.
Yes.
I'm really grateful that listeners often take us up on this invitation. And a listener of the Wednesday Conversation, who we'll refer to by his first name, Jason, enjoys smoking meat. And last week he drove up to our building with a trailer attached that had lots of smoked meat on it. And he gave some to us as a gift. And then he specifically asked that one portion of this meat be devoted to the Wednesday Conversation crew. So
giving us energy as we think.
So even as we talk right now, we're consuming this delicious smoked roasted pork. And it's quite delightful. I may fall asleep and take a nap here in a few minutes during our conversation because I'm satisfied with this delicious smoked meat that is before us. So thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate you.
And hey, come on, rest of you listeners. We can expand the circle of blessing here. We'd be happy to partake of whatever you want to bring
us.
I
just want to put in, next time it would be great to have a dessert. So those of you that like to make desserts.
Wow. Pies?
Just advocating pies.
You guys like pies?
Cupcake.
Yep.
Wow.
Just saying.
It's starting to feel a little bit like a real shameless plea for people to bring us stuff. So we're just going to move on to our content now. Hey, one of the most helpful, I think, and most intelligent minds of the current day is Mark Sayers. He's a pastor in Australia. You may be familiar with him if you follow sort of cultural commentary. He's a really good, insightful voice on culture. He's written a number of books, but just recently he came out with this book called Reappearing Church. It's published by Moody Publishers, and it's sort of a distilling of some things he's been talking about over the past year as he sort of analyzes the culture of the West. And so when we say the West, you know, he's in Australia, we're in America, but we both share this sort of European cultural heritage, this Western civilization sort of heritage. And so what he's seeing in his own culture also applies to ours and to most other cultures that have that sort of Western cultural heritage. And so we're going to talk about this book for two episodes. We're not going to really review the book and tell you everything in it, but what we want to do is engage with a couple of key observations that we feel like are really helpful for Christians trying to live faithfully in a post-Christian world. Here's the subtitle of the book, The Hope for Renewal in the Rise of Our Post-Christian Culture. Sayers wants to make the case that the culture we live in is sort of falling apart and fraying at the seams, and that that's actually a really good thing for the gospel. In fact, the way he says it is, what if all the bad news in the world is actually good news for the church? What if what looks like decline in the church is actually the beginning of a spiritual awakening? So he's talking about, hey, you know, by every cultural barometer, the church is declining. You know, church attendance is declining. People who profess religion is declining in the West. And people hear these stats a lot, and we fret a little bit about the loss of the church's influence. But he says, actually, this could be a really wonderful thing. This could be the cusp of spiritual awakening. And so we're going to talk specifically about some of his insights into where our culture is and what that means for us. Before we do that, guys, I just wanted to get your thoughts on what was your overall opinion of the book, and was there anything particularly that sort of resonated with you?
I think one of the things that I most appreciated about the book is he has essentially distilled down the thoughts of multiple authors, philosophers, theologians, cultural commentators that I think we've used on the podcast. I know have been influential in different ways. And so to sort of see some of those streams kind of come together in a very thoughtful, helpful way, that I really appreciate it. I appreciate someone who can always synthesize a lot of different ideas well and kind of create this coherent picture and show that there are a lot of different voices talking about the same thing in different ways. So even just for that aspect, reading this book as a synthesis of some different ideas is really a worthwhile exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been listening to a podcast he's been on called This Cultural Moment for last 8-9 months, maybe a year, and it's just helpful to have all of his thoughts that he's talked about in multiple episodes, multiple 12 to 15 minute episodes in writing, so I can spend time with them and highlight them and talk about them and share them with others beyond just a audio format. It's nice having it all in a book.
The book is 194 pages and paperback, so it's a really easy read. And like you said, Chris, the payoff of it is you will get a really deep dive into and a synthesis of really important voices like Charles Taylor, James K. Smith, Richard Lovelace. And he's just bringing all that together in a really accessible and coherent way. And that's what he's really good at.
Mm-hmm. If Richard Lovelace and James K. Smith had a baby,
are you about to say it would be Mark Sayers?
It would be this book.
Oh, okay. It would be this book.
At least that's what I kind of got from it.
Yeah, yeah.
If they wrote a book together, it would be
this
book.
Oh, maybe that's a better way to put it. Yes.
If they wrote a book together.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so we're specifically going to talk about two chapters in this book, chapter 4 and chapter 11. And we're just going to sort of, those are the key places where we found some really, really important insights for Christian leaders and for thoughtful Christians living in the world we live in. His point in chapter 4 is this, that what's going on in Western culture is an attempt at renewal that factors out God. So he's saying, hey, renewal follows a certain pattern. And what secular culture is trying to do is bring about renewal without Christianity and without God. And it's really interesting how he describes that. He calls it post-Christian personal renewal. And he says basically, here's what's happened in modern culture. Modern culture has cut away all sources of meaning. So everything from the falling apart of the family and the deconstructing of traditional sex and gender roles to the sort of, you know, existential philosophers and the undercutting of the idea of truth, all of these things have taken away places people traditionally went for meaning. And so now we have no meaning and we feel the emptiness of that. We feel the flatness of that. Again, this is something James K. Smith has talked about and others, right? We are aware that we're in this world that lacks a sense of gravity and meaning and depth and significance. And so what the consumer culture offers us is solutions to the problem of the empty self. Here's how Sayers talks about it. He says there's four elements of post-Christian personal renewal. Number one, we are born innocent, happy, and whole. Our inner child or inner self is good. So there's a clear departure from biblical anthropology, but really important that you understand that's the starting point. The starting point is, hey, who you are in your inner self is good. Point number two, families, bad experiences, binding commitments, externally given identities, cultural, traditional, and religious restrictions make us unhappy and give us low self-esteem. So the problem is your family, your experiences, binding commitments, the identities you've picked up. These are the problem. And point number three is by escaping these things, we discover our inner self, which is good and can guide us. And then step four, through finding a missing element, such as a soulmate, a meaningful career, enjoyable experiences, material things, or by exercising our self-expression, our lives can be filled with pleasure and meaning. So here's the point Sayers is making. He's saying the modern culture itself created the problem of the empty self, and now it's offering you solutions to not be so empty. And this whole thing is how consumerism actually works. Mm. What a consumer culture needs in order to thrive is it needs you to feel like you're empty and you're missing something in life. And it needs the answer to be something it can sell you or offer you or provide for you. And so he says, our consumer-shaped culture offers us endless promises to fill our empty selves, which it creates in the first place. Mm. And so he's just talking about, if you step back and just start to see that, it can really free you from that cycle. Because what you have to realize is the problems you're trying to solve were created by modern culture in the first place. Why do you feel so empty? Why do you lack meaning? Why does it feel like things are flat and sort of empty? And not very satisfying. Well, because modern culture created all of that in the first place, mm-hmm. By stripping away all the things we sort of traditionally found meaning in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun. It's a fun game that I play with my kids. We're watching TV to talk about commercials and to talk about, okay, that commercial's selling us a car, but what are they saying that car is going to give us? Mm. And it's fun to see them kind of think through, oh, that car is going to give me happiness, or that car is going to get me a girl or a guy, or I'm going to have a lot of friends riding in the car with me. and so it's evident even to children that things are attached to meaning and fulfillment, and they get that. And it's easy to see in our culture.
This is an interesting insight. He says older forms of consumerism required the individual to travel to stores or malls in search of satisfaction.
Yeah.
The next stage of intensified consumerism comes to us in the form of home delivery, downloads, and streaming, all increasing the strength of our individualism. So the next wave of consumerism is, hey, you don't have to leave and go anywhere. We'll bring it all to you. We'll stream it. We'll bring it to your smartphone. You can get your groceries delivered to your house. It's this hyper-intensified individualism and consumerism. And yet he's saying, statistically, if you pay attention to what's happening, it's making people more and more empty, less and less fulfilled. It's not delivering on the promises that it makes us.
Mm-hmm. Something I've always found fascinating, the irony of humanism, is how this, as it becomes more and more radical, more and more individualistic, to where throwing off all restrictions, even biological restrictions to identity, all external sort of sources of meaning, it becomes anti-humanistic. So the more you ratchet up humanism, the more it actually leaves these empty selves. And as we've seen this, as we become just increasingly individualized, and where self-expression becomes the highest good, and sort of living out of that inner self becomes the highest good, we've turned on ourselves. And more, you know, that we become more anxious, and we've become more image driven because we have to cover that sense of emptiness inside. So it, you know, what kind of implicit in here, what he's getting at in this chapter, is just this idea of that the humanistic promise that we can trace all the way back to the Enlightenment, which over these several hundred years has just become more and more and more and more radical, has completely failed in its promise.
Well, even the Psalms fill us in on using the language of idolatry. It says, Psalm 136, I think it says, that you've become like the things that you've made, mm-hmm. and those things are empty and they're lifeless. And when you worship those things, when you make those things ultimate, you become empty and lifeless yourself.
So Sayers is playing, is running a play here that I've seen Cornelius Van Til and others in the sort of presuppositionalist apologetic camp make, which is what he's saying is, hey, progressive atheism, or the progressive secular vision of the world, is just is borrowing Christianity, is using the Christian scheme. So what he talks about is, you know, in the progressive vision of the world, Christianity is the heresy that needs to be jettisoned. You know, if we can just get rid of Christianity, then we can really achieve and have the fullness of what we're hoping for. What Sayers says is, here's what progressivism has sold us. And when he says us, he means the people who live in Western culture, right? Everyone who's immersed in this sort of cultural tradition. What we've been told is, hey, more and more freedom, more and more independence, more and more affluence, you know, getting rid of these binding commitments that weigh us down and these traditional mores and values that sort of hold us back. What this will move us toward is utopia. We'll really have happiness and fulfillment and satisfaction and the kind of society we want. What Sayers says is, the reason there's so much anger in Western culture right now, the reason you see so much polarization politically, the reason you see so many people sort of outraged, is because that very promise is showing itself to be untrue, but people don't have any alternatives. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is, if you've been told that, hey, progress will lead us into human flourishing, and you look around at your life and you're not seeing human flourishing, you're less happy and more anxious and less fulfilled and more lonely, you start to freak out, because there's, you're not sure what to do with the fact that the thing that you've been told isn't materializing. So what he says is, let me read a section from page 59. We have endless opportunities to pursue pleasure, yet so many of us are miserable and anxious. We can traverse geography, time, and space, yet loneliness is growing. Silicon Valley's promises that a world connected by social media will be a better, more tolerant world now look ridiculous. The assurances that a globalized world will be a fairer, more peaceful, and prosperous place seem shaky. These failed promises are fueling a growing sense of dissatisfaction, a desire to see things change, a hunger for a vision of personal and social life in which humans flourish. What Sayers wants you to see as a Christian is, this is why the people around you have some angst. They're not coming to you saying, hey, you know what? I've realized that the promises of progressivism have failed. Do you have a better answer? You know, the questions aren't framed in that way because people are not self-aware of these gaps. But what he's saying is this is why there's so much political and social unrest. This is why there's a lot of outrage on social media. This is why people are growing more and more anxious and more depressed. These are all symptoms of a failure of the progressive vision of society to deliver what it promises.
So to your point, Bob, about the lack of self-awareness, as pastors, as those who are missionally engaged in our culture, to our neighbors, how do we sort of get at that sense of self-awareness?
It's really hard. And the only way you can do it is in meaningful conversation. Because people aren't reflecting on the emptiness of their life before a Husker game. You know, this comes in sort of those weird moments where you're standing outside with a neighbor and, you know, it's the end of a day and the conversation just turns in a meaningful direction all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. So you got to capitalize on those moments. And I think there's, I usually try to just use the question, how's that working for you? You know, because and I talked about this in a sermon recently. Sayers basically says, think about life having three containers, right? There's the container of freedom. There's the container of meaning. And there's the container of relationships. And what we've been told in the West is if we just pour pour all the gasoline into the tank of freedom, that's enough to run our lives on. Mm. And so he said, that's what we've done is we've done that, but we haven't put anything in the tank of meaning or in the tank of relationship. And those tanks are empty. And so that's why we're running dry. And you can't run life on just hyper freedom. And it's interesting. He uses the language. He's not the only writer that I've seen do this. A lot of people are talking about, think about, for instance, the whole argument over gender identity, right? That the promise being sold right now is if you free yourself from binding obligations, right? Gender is a binding obligation. You're either a man or a woman. Well, if you step outside of that and just free yourself from that binding obligation, then you'll be truly free. So that's what all of the gender revolution is seeking to do, is to say, let's rebel against these givens, these things that create a sense of obligation. But if you study the mental health effects of that decision, it's astronomically bad for people. Mm-hmm. And so I think what's going to happen is, and Sayers is basically saying this, is like in the next couple of decades, we're going to see the crashing down of personal fulfillment. Because it's already happening. It's happening with technology. You see the rise of depression. You see the rise of suicide. Life expectancy in the United States has declined for the past 3 straight years. You already see the effects of this deep loss of meaning that is taking place. And so, you know, you're right that you can't force that realization or that awareness on anyone. You just sort of have to be there to be in conversation with them as they feel it happening.
Yeah, step into those moments where, they're feeling sense of isolation or, I mean, whether it be relational fracture or a sense of not having purpose in life or meaning in life, or that the things that they've been chasing for that feeling empty. I think that's one thing. I'm compelled by the fracture side of this. The relational fracture side of this. So I think for a long time it was getting at the meaning and purpose. And I think that's super important. But within maybe the past 10 years or so, we're seeing social fragmentation happening at an alarming rate. And that seems to be kind of rising to the surface in some ways as kind of entry points for conversations along this line.
This is an interesting observation. He says the hardware of the West, our roads, our hospitals, our safety initiatives, our institutions, is good hardware, which creates the possibility of living lives of flourishing. Yet we are running infected software, a vision of individual life, freedom, and happiness that undermines the benefits of our hardware. I think that in itself is a brilliant cultural observation. The West has created the best hardware in the world. I mean, we have the best hospitals, we have the best educational system, we have the right. We have some of the best infrastructure there's ever been in the world, but the software we're running in our system is bad software. And so the helping people see the dissonance between those two things. Hey, how come since we have the best healthcare that's ever existed in history, how come there's more suicide than there has been in a long time? If our educational system is so good, why are so many people falling behind economically? Just by contrasting the expectations of that hardware with the actuality, it helps us to sort of put our finger on one of the problems.
Yeah, another one, we have some of the most insightful research on sociology and psychology, but yet we're emotionally stunted.
Here's one of the most provocative statements in this chapter. Some outliers are able to flourish within the West personally, from those who refuse to engage with new technologies to those who possess large reserves of personal will or discipline. Yet these people flourish by ignoring the powerful formational tools operating across the social and personal environment. Such individuals are definitely the minority, for the system is increasingly rigged against us. That statement stopped me in my tracks when I read it, and here's why. Because I think that this is one of the naiveties, I think, that is present within the church and that's present within Christian parents.
Wow.
Is to think, hey, because we're disciples of Jesus, because we have a practice of, you know, worship and prayer and these things, that's going to be sufficient to insulate us against the sort of buffeting effects of hyper-individualism and of loneliness and of rebellion and all these things. Essentially what he's saying is, hey, that's only true for a really small subset of people that either have strong willpower in the first place, they're just like stubborn people, and so they have good resolve, or they're really good at refusing, you know, they're sort of Luddites when it comes to technology. They're saying, you know, I'm not going to have a smartphone or whatever. The rest of us ignore the effect of powerful formational tools. Like we ignore how deformative the world that we live in is. And I think that's a really important observation because it's going to play into what we talk about next week on the podcast, which has to do with how much more intentionality we need to put toward the practices and patterns that are actually shaping us. This statement was really powerful to me because I just realized, oh, I've never thought about the fact that life has probably shaped in me a certain amount of willpower that I take for granted that just isn't there in a lot of people. Not because they're not good people, but because they've just been immersed in deformative environments in different ways, whether that's family or society or, you know, whatever else. And so I think sometimes as a pastor, I can have this assumption of like, well, if we all just commit to these disciplines, then we'll be fine. You know, like, let's just be people who are disciplined to fast and to pray and to worship and to do these things. And Sayers is basically saying, I don't think that takes into account how deformative all the influences around us are. I don't know. What are your thoughts, guys?
Yeah, the pastoral challenge there is interesting because it's not a one thing fixes all, you know. Everyone's shaped uniquely. Everyone has specific stories and struggles, and so approaching those conversations and relationships is going to take some patience and listening and understanding the nuance of how those things and culture shape people differently and to different intensities.
Yeah, it also occurs to me that we may need to be okay with being misunderstood too, because to some degree, okay, like the person who's the Luddite, you know, I don't have a smartphone, I reject technology. Do we have to be that to resist these culturally formative practices? Maybe not, but we at least need to have that conversation and not be afraid of being called legalistic or Luddite or maybe even radically shifting how much we engage certain practices. So pastorally speaking, I think we need to be willing to have certain conversations and to put certain things on the table for the sake of not being naive and not being afraid.
When you say have certain conversations and put certain things on the table, what do you mean?
I'm saying that as a pastor, if I'm talking about spiritual formation to parents or to individuals, that I'm asking questions about, hey, how much are you on that phone? How much are you ingesting social media or other types of media? How much are you ingesting certain entertainment practices, or what do the spiritually formative practices look like in your life? And we don't like those conversations because they sound legalistic or they sound fundy in some ways. And if what Sayers is saying is true, that these practices are so powerful, that to break out of their spell, there's not an easy fix, that maybe we need to ratchet up our conversations to some degree. That's the thought that occurs to me.
Yeah, I was going to say, so far you haven't said anything about in the conversation that would set me back very much. If you just asked me like, how's my use of social media, I would say, oh, it's fine, Chris. Thanks for asking.
Or tell people to get off social
media.
Yeah.
That's the more challenging thing, is like just saying, hey, get off that.
Mm. Right. Right. Stop. Get a dumb phone, get a flip phone.
Yeah.
Don't watch Netflix every night. So
let me out my kid's school, because it's my testing ground for this problem. My kids attend a local high school. It's a smaller school. It's a Christian school. And for the past 3 years, I've been having a conversation with the administrators at that school about the prevalence of technology in the classroom. And not just in the classroom, but in the school. Everybody has a smartphone. Every kid can bring their smartphone to class. Teachers are frustrated because you can't get the kids away from the smartphone long enough for them to actually meaningfully engage with any subject. I've been pressing the administration, hey, why don't you just tell kids they can't bring phones to school? And you would be amazed at the response is like, well, I mean, parents would be really unhappy because they wouldn't be able to communicate their kids throughout the day. And I'm like, well, I went to high school and mom could call the office and they would send someone down to get me. Like, you actually can. You can't communicate immediately right now in 10 seconds with your kid, but that's not an insurmountable obstacle. But it's just, to me, that whole conversation is a microcosm of the problem that Sayers is bringing up, which is we've so bought into freedom. Think about, technology is really a promise of freedom. It's a promise of accessibility. It's a promise of my kid can never be out of my sight. I always know where they are. I can always get a hold of them. If anything happens, I can be the first to know. That promise of sort of that kind of autonomy and freedom is worth then trading all the deformative effects that technology has, especially on teenagers. That's the trade-off that we're making, or that the school is making at the very least. And to me, that's the very problem Sayers is bringing to the table, is to say, hey, in the name of freedom and autonomy and independence and accessibility, we're trading away the opportunity to form our kids in ways that actually would help them become more focused and more diligent learners and students and whatever. And that's just one instance of the problem. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder if over time, the proof will be in the pudding. You know, if the harmful effects of these things will become so obvious that it'll force us to sort of step back and go, maybe we need to be more prescriptive in how
Right. And where do those conversations happen? Do you think those conversations go case by case, or do you get up in the pulpit and say, hey, as a church, we're all smashing our smartphones?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the...
Smash your cell phone Sunday.
There you go.
That's, I mean, that would coming be, up on the calendar.
That would be so cool.
Yeah.
We're going to just get a big like grinder and we're just going to throw them in.
Ooh. That would be awesome. I'll come to church that day.
Well, Bob, we were just talking about the other day, the practice of fasting from things like technology, not because technology is bad, but to limit yourself for the self-discipline that thing is not going to control you. And so if you're not,
that's important.
If you're not, you know, going to go all the way and say, I'm getting rid of all technology and not going to have Wi-Fi and all that stuff, there are good things that you can do to say, I'm going to limit myself for a season just to exercise and discipline myself in the ways of those things not having a control and such a forming influence on my heart.
Yeah.
So Sayers's angle here, the reason he wants to talk to us about these things is because he wants the church, he wants Christians who care, who love the Lord and who love the world to contend for renewal. He wants us to get on our knees. He wants us to start seeking the Lord. He wants us to get serious about experiencing and seeking and longing for spiritual renewal. And he says this is a important moment for the West. This cultural decline, this religious decline, this decline in participation in church, all of these factors are indicators that we're on the cusp of perhaps awakening and revival and God doing something new. And what looks like decline might actually be the preparation for awakening, which is exciting to me. And honestly, I heard Sayers say that on his podcast before I read it in this book, Mike, but that was sort of like a refreshing way of thinking to me, because I tend to be a pessimist, especially about culture. I tend to be one who sort of can see all the deleterious and damaging things happening and say, well, this isn't headed in a good direction. And so for someone like Sayers to reframe that and say, yep, things are declining, let's not pretend they're not, but historically, that's always when renewal is most likely to happen, is when religiosity declines, when people's comfort is stripped away, when the things that they lean on for meaning and purpose are fragmenting and falling apart. That's the moment when the gospel begins to have a lot of power in the lives of Christians and a lot of power in the culture around them.
What excites me about what Sayers is saying in this book and is that if more people can be encouraged by that, and we can be on board as a church, as Christians, like, hey, the kingdom of God is coming. Let's work together to see this, whether it comes in our generation or the next, let's work towards this end, because the gospel and the kingdom of God has a hopeful end. And that's what drives us to discipline ourselves and when it's not cool, and to do the things Sayers is talking about. And so I'm excited about people being excited about the gospel, people being excited about renewal, and really committing to live towards those ends.
Well, and maybe the fruit here, Mike, is if this can shift us from a fearful posture to a hopeful posture.
Yes.
Yeah.
If we can stop fretting about the decline of the West, and if we can say, hey, maybe the decline of the West is the best thing that could happen to the West.
Yeah.
In the same way that the rise of the communists in China and the kicking out of all Western missionaries was the best thing for Chinese Christianity that probably ever happened in the 20th century. It looked like a major defeat for the church, but it ended up being the raw material of renewal. You know, could the same thing be true in our own world, in our own culture, that what looks like decline really is hopeful? And so our posture can shift from one of sort of fearing the decline of our culture and lamenting it to hoping in the midst of it that God is going to pour out something new and renew us in ways we didn't expect.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from you, the listener. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topic ideas, send us an email, podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next Wednesday for another Wednesday conversation.